Session number 32586, reel 3.
Did you return to pretty much the same role when you went to Washington and rejoined the RAF?
Yes. Yeah, sure. It's identical. We did night duties. Gradually increased the number from about 6 to about 40. We were lectured, as I told you, not to discuss politics in any way, not to push how clever you were or how well your wartime plans were going. Just shut your mouth, you know. It's not easy. I think they were very nice to us, really.
Had there been any change in the cipher system itself, or the machines you were using?
Sure, yeah. They added fiendish little extra gadgets, and you had to relearn the system a couple of times. But you had to learn on the job. And we were not cuddled. We were in, we'd go on night duty in an old van with this driver. And as I told somebody, I think it was at your office, we lost two girls, were killed by coming on duty at night because a drunken Marine ran into them. And they tried very hard to make up for that by giving them a very nice funeral and burying them at Arlington. Two more were killed on the way down to Nassau. They just flew in, you know, to the ocean. It was the end of them. It was difficult to be here because at that time there was a lot of bombing going on here, and the girls working were worrying about their families, who really couldn't tell them very much because their letters were all checked. So they would have occasional snip fits, you know, get the weeps or something. We had a very good commanding officer here. She was three parts nanny. And, you know, the girls would get homesick, or they'd get drink too much, or they'd get sick, she had a job. She was good. The other services had mixed emotions, I think, because we thought we were better than anybody, which we were, of course. And they had just started, and they wanted to show us how we should really do things. And we just didn't quite see it that way. So our commanding officer would lecture us. Now, don't get argumentative. You know. Don't tell them that's stupid. Just be nice, you know. But occasionally we would get into arguments with them, which was kind of fun.
What sort of messages were passing back and forth then?
Everything imaginable. A lot of it, we had codes from New Zealand, Australia, several different outside groups. The aircraft production, several non-aviation groups. We were just strictly business, suppliers, you know, trying to, and they didn't want their situations known. They were trying to do their business without the Germans finding out how bad things were, how short of food they were. we handled about 8 different codes, I would say. And they were, some of them mechanical, some of them were book codes. We had to occasionally give lectures to groups of pilots going overseas who would have to use different forms of code when in flight, and we had to teach them those. But mostly it was just, you'd come into the office in the morning, and once you got by the guard, and there'd be a pile like this. And the girls that were going off at night would have done the big ones, the ones that had, you know, important labels on them. They had to be done right away. And then we were stuck with these long, endless production ones and orders and complaints and bitches and things like that. And troop notices, and then just technical stuff, engines and production, and personal remarks, some of which were quite astonishing. And we had fun, you know, we would say, hey, listen to this one, you know, so-and-so says somebody else is a, you know, a shithead or something. And then we would get the ones we couldn't break. And you got one of those, it would spend the whole day on it. And then we would have to take it back to the teleprinter girls and say, we'll return this for a redo. It was hard work. It was extremely uncomfortable. We worked in an empty room with nothing in it but, say, 40 machines, all gurgling and panting and grinding. And as I mentioned earlier, the heat was bad. It was no good opening the window because it was just as hot outside, but God, we would come in there and strip off. It was the only thing to do. We'd be running around in our bras and panties and, you know, trying to keep cool. We got very close to each other, and some of the girls would have a bad time. Maybe they'd get into trouble with a boyfriend, or their families at home would write and say, you know, we need you and it's not going well, or someone, your brother just got killed or whatever. And we tried to take care of each other, to keep up. And we had very good officers. It was a tough job because there weren't too many people to turn to. Now, the Americans did their best. Now, for instance, they gave us free access to Walter Reed, and I can't recall what else there was.
This is a hospital.
Trying to remember.
Yes, it's the Army Hospital.
Yeah, and so we could go there, you know, and they would do anything for us. They tried to make it easier for us, and they loaned us, if we requested, you know, troops to clean something, or we needed another vehicle or stuff like that. They were very good. We had to be careful of them, of course. And all our people weren't perfect, oddly enough. We had people who had breakdowns, or people who got sick, or people who lost their tempers or made scenes, and, you know, it was just, I suppose, like any big company, you have to have a nurse on hand or something, and they shared all that kind of thing with us. tried to help. When you went to Nassau or Dayton, they would always arrange for, because in Dayton we were covering their field. And Nassau was a mess. That they had the Prince of Wales down there, along with Mrs. Simpson. After he resigned, he went to Nassau. And I was down there then, doing a, we had two field airfields down there. So there's a lot to do. And at one end of the island was the governor's mansion, and that's where they were living. And we were instructed, no, don't go near it. And the pilots were told not to fly over it. And we never saw hide or hair of them. But we knew they were there. And we kept getting little questions on the machine as to, is everything okay, you know? Check it out. That was weird.
How long were you stationed in Washington for?
Well, I went in and out. I mean, I was in D.C. a couple of years, I guess. But part of that, I went up to New York for a while, and I went down to Nassau. And I was at Dayton. That was Wright Field, which we covered. And that was really strange. They had no place for us to find an office, so we were up over a gas station, over the top of it. It was really, we got to be very friends, good friends with the guys in the gas station. All together, I mean, it's all been scattered. I guess if you put the whole length of service together, it would come out to be about 4.5 years. And about 6 months off to regroup in the middle. And then I ended up marrying an American. Surprise, another pilot, yeah. And we got married, and he trotted off to China. They sent him to China, of all places, poor soul. But he came back. Of course, I got pregnant again, so that was the end of my wonderful service, the grand finale.
Did America joining the war change the nature of your work?
Not much, just doubled it. I mean, quantity. They were totally unskilled and uninterested when they joined the war and became really active. They did not understand secrecy. It's not in your nature. So, you know, we had to help, and we did loan them people and showed them how we managed to dodge having people reading our secret messages that you didn't want to. You had to really know what you were doing, because it's a tricky business. And the most complicated isn't necessarily the best. You have to figure, well, you've got speed, you've got clarity, you've got just simple ease, and also the fact that there's somebody watching you all the time. That's always disturbing. We found we had a guard that was devious, shall we say. We had to get rid of him in a hurry. you get careless. That's what happens, I guess, in any army. Or you get used to the people working with you, and you get used to your situation and where you are, and, well, I don't need to lock that door. I'm only going to be gone a few minutes, you know. And after a while, you get a bit brainwashed. You start getting, ooh, gosh, can't do that. Don't talk to him, you know. Funny. It's a peculiar world. And it worked out very well for women, I think, because, frankly, you wouldn't want to waste your top guys fiddling with codes. We've got more important things and more dangerous things for you to do. Isn't that nice? So it was a good way for us to contribute, I think.
Did that then have an effect on how you felt women's roles in society should change or develop after the war?
Oh, yeah. We thought we were running everything. We were... it was almost unnoticed that there was a difference. But after a while, when you see, you walk onto a station and the little airman who presents arms, and you walk along a little while and some poor soul goes by and gives you a snappy salute, you sort of get a little vain. And they used to brainwash us when we were learning. They'd say, they're not saluting you. They're saluting the arms on your hat. Well, sure they are, you know. But that was, especially when we came to Washington, because the American troops didn't quite understand how this worked. And they'd see someone salute us, they sort of thought, huh? But they learned, they were good.
You notice a difference then between the way the British and Americans regarded
women? Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Yeah. I think the British are better at military manners. Well, they're accustomed to it. And they've had great military groups that have been famous all over the world. I mean, we went and watched them yesterday, didn't we? We went over to Buckingham Palace and watched the doodah going on, you know, and I thought, oh, yeah, it's lovely, you know. So you guys are accustomed to it a little more in your history. I'm sure it was a difficult moment the first time a guy saluted some large female. Probably thought, do I have to do this? Yeah. They got used to it. It's like everything else you don't want to do. Yeah.
What happened to you then after the war?
That was the anticlimax of the century. You felt a bit bereft. It's a silly word, but it was kind of the feeling. The companionship was gone. The self-importance you'd achieved was gone. You're just another woman in a coat and skirt, you know, walking along. You weren't doing anything special for somebody else. It was a little bit of a climb down, I think. Yeah, missed it. And you missed the companionship. It was a wonderful time in a dreadful sort of way. Good and bad.
What do you remember of the VE Day itself and then VJ Day?
Not much.
Was necessary? Did you wish anything?
Did you find, as a Canadian, you were regarded differently?
Yes, definitely.
Both in America and in Britain.
Well, and I insisted on it. You know, I did, how bossy I was. I think it was extremely helpful because I didn't fit into a slot, you know. I think as a too young girl, it helped me get out of the lower ranks because I didn't have a Cockney accent and I was more independent. And when I went to my class officers' school, they thought I was fun and they liked to hear me make these funny noises that I didn't talk properly, thank God. Yeah. I think the whole thing gave me a break because I was a little different. So that gave me a little jumping space, you know. Always helps. And with the girls, they loved it. The girls were very nice with me. Even when I had to correct them or something, they thought it was as bad as having somebody really yell at them. I would yell at them too, but I would yell at them in a funny way with a strange voice, and they thought it was a scream. And we used to have arguments because they never wanted to go into the shelter. They wanted to stand outside and stare at the sky and see what their boyfriends were doing or something. And I would be in charge of a couple of trenches or something, and I had to get them back down. It used to drive me crazy, you know. I'd jump up and down and yell at them, and they would laugh, you know. But they would do it. They were, I like to think they were fond of me, mostly because I was a little different. So it was a break, which I worked hard, and it was rewarding. The officer teaching the class would notice he'd got an odd one because she sounded funny. So that helped.
Did you regard yourself as particularly Canadian? Or
did I what?
Regard yourself as particularly Canadian? Or
yeah, I think so. It's a nice thing to be. You don't have to work too hard at it. Yeah.
She still does. She's lived in the United States since 1945?
Yeah, that's about right.
She still will tell you she's Canadian.
It's a good thing to be. Yeah.
And she lives in a foreign country.
That's right. I'm a stranger.
How did what was the general regard in Canada for Britain and the Empire and
oh, that's easy. The whole Empire, when England went to war, we went to war at the same second. And when we got our troops together and sent them over as fast as we could, we didn't regard ourselves as separate. When most of us came from Scotland or England or Wales or somewhere peculiar, and was never any doubt. It was something we'd done before. Almost everybody I know had parents who were in World War I, still complaining, you know. That's about all I can contribute, I think.
What was the atmosphere on the whole like in America after the war then, when you were living there?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I wasn't really quite familiar enough with the general public. We were kept a little bit separate. I think they were just glad it was over and they could get on with what was left. I think perhaps things may have changed. There's still a difference in those two countries, in manners and general behavior. One is quicker than the other, and maybe even more intelligent, whereas the Canadians are easier going, a little gentler. I think they're more fun.
Did you return to work after the war?
I never worked a nickel. Nobody did. Women didn't work. Well, of course some women worked, but mostly, and after the war, it was tough to get a job, and there wasn't enough to get around, to go around, rather. And there was an awful lot of catch-up to be done, and child-raising, and greeting your husband, who you hadn't seen for a couple of years, you know. And I had to join in on all that, in that I had a new husband and an existing family, and the poor guy, you know, had to come home from China and meet a kid he'd never seen and hope to make a good impression, you know. He was really concerned that it should go off well, you know. Of course, the kid was ecstatic. You know. It was very nice. That was a funny time. There was so many soap operas going on. I mean, there were people I knew who had been having a busy time while their boyfriends or husbands were away, and then had to kind of try to get it all back together again. And there were people who didn't want to go on with married life that had been lapsed for 2 or 3 years. And they didn't send troops home on leave in those days. If you were in I don't know about the American services, but in the Canadian services, once you were in the Army, you were in the Army. You didn't get to go home for leave every 6 months or something. You were stuck, and my sister's husband was gone for 3 years. He was a nice guy, too. So it was a kind of reassessing and regrouping, trying to figure out how it was all going to work. It was a busy time, and there was an awful lot of catch-up to play. And I'm sure that was true of the companies who would be rearranging themselves and hiring more or maybe less. Nobody quite knew how it was going to go. You know, it's kind of an uneasy time. I mean, we were all ecstatic the war was over, but then what? Okay, so it's over, now what do we do? You know, a little scary. And a lot of families, my family lost my brother at Dunkirk, and my husband's family had lost their